Oh, thou got lots of bread and gravy all the time. Bread and gravy, but lots of bread and gravy. Beans and bacon, got lots of beans and bacon. No more fretting now that I'm getting lots of bread and gravy all the time. Peace and quiet.
Hello and welcome to episode 3.6, the November 22nd, 2023 Sausage Stuffing Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I consider myself pretty much a no-frills person. I drive a 14-year-old car. My house still has furnishings that I acquired secondhand. And my wardrobe is bone basic, consisting mostly of blue jeans and seasonally appropriate earth tone shirts. So, if I was presented with a Thanksgiving meal of sausage, stuffing, and gravy, you know what? I'd be a pretty happy guy. While I do enjoy a juicy turkey, the highlight of any Thanksgiving meal for me is always the stuffing. It doesn't have to be sausage. It could be apple or squash or walnut. But it does have to come with gravy. And that's how I feel about this episode. Sort of a no-frills episode, made of some good, solid interviews with plenty of gravy on the side. You get to decide which is the stuffing and which is the gravy. So, let's get to listening.
Got a reason to feel swell, and my clothes all fit me well, 'cause I wear a nice ring.
The production by the Department of Theater and Dance of the original script, Mason Wright Is Not a Mother, marks an historic moment. For the first time that I am aware of, two students are at the helm of a Walter Gluer main stage series show. Ashley Giacco, who has written the play, and Alexa Adler, who is the production's director, are the two students who are bringing this work to life. Not surprisingly, they are two articulate, intelligent, and sensitive young women, as you will discover as you listen to this interview. Well, I have to say I'm very excited for my next two guests. They are unusual guests in a certain sort of way. They are two students, both of whom are senior BFA musical theater majors at SUNY Fredonia, the Department of Theater and Dance. And one of them, who is the author of the play Mason Wright Is Not a Mother, is also a minor in creative writing. And so I would like to introduce to the audience Ashley Giacco. She is the author. She is the one with the minor in creative writing. And also on the team is Alexa Adler. Alexa is the director. Ladies, to both of you, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm going to start with Ashley, since she is the author of the play. But Ashley, let me ask you just to begin with your interest in playwriting and creating this particular theatrical piece. How did that develop for you?
I've always really had an interest in playwriting, just writing in general, really. It's just I have this massive fascination with words and how we can use it to manipulate, you know, memories and just the world around us. So I've been writing theatrical things since I was in like 10th grade, but it wasn't until the spring of my sophomore year where I reached out to Dan Lenzian, who's a professor at the university, to do an independent study in playwriting. And this was sort of a project that I came up with at the end of that semester after I went to the doctor and they told me that I had PCOS, which is basically can cause infertility in women, which scared me a lot.
I would imagine.
Yeah. So I just wrote this 10-page scene about a girl going to the doctor and finding out that she can't have children. And then I found out a few weeks later that they misdiagnosed me at 15 with that disorder, which then just sent me into a whole spiral of how can I write a piece of theater that really encapsulates everything to do with fertility and how that relates to our womanhood and our motherhood, and how medical malpractice is so rampant among like just communities of women. I mean, every woman that I have talked to about this, no matter their age, has told me a story about a doctor not believing one of their friends and their friends not getting the treatment that they needed that could have saved their life. Like women who were 15 years old getting married to people much older than 22 back in like the 50s and my grandmother's time. So I wanted to write a play that sort of encapsulates all of that. And I think we did. I think with the help of Dan and the writers group and really the actors, after casting it, it's informed so much of this play. And I'm so grateful to like share it with everybody.
That's great. What a great story. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Alexa, you are the director of this piece. So let me ask you what you're interested in directing, how you got pulled into this project.
So in October of 2022, Ashley approached me and said, "Hey, I need an actor for this reading of this one act play that I'm doing. Would you be interested?" And I was like, "Yeah, of course, I would love to." And it was the very first draft of Mason Wright Is Not a Mother. So I went, I did the reading, and I thought it was one of the most brilliant plays I had ever read, and it wasn't even anywhere near what it is now. And I approached her later in the day and I said, "Hey, I don't know if you plan on doing anything with this show, but I would love to direct it." So from there, she said yes. And we were going to pitch it to our school's performing arts company. And then one day, Ashley approached me and said, "This is actually going to be a main stage." So I put in my letter to, be able to direct, and I was picked. And from there, I have been set to direct. It was last semester that I was set to direct. So this summer, I did a lot of work prepping for it. And we came back, we had a bunch of meetings, we cast the show, and I was able to direct it. And I think the reasoning behind why I wanted to direct it was because I personally could relate to it so much because of the themes and the content and even like the ages used. It was so specific to me in my life that I felt like I could really make it personal.
You ladies realize that with this project, you're creating history, correct?
Correct.
Okay. You are the first two students ever to direct and write a production for the Walter Gluer main stage series, as far as I'm aware of. And my institutional memory goes back pretty far. How does that make you feel? I mean, what does that mean to the both of you? Can we start with Ashley?
Yeah, I mean, super giddy to start out with. It's really an honor. And the more I think about it, the more grateful I become. And I really am honored to have this opportunity to share this story with the audiences that the main stage series brings in. I mean, to produce this independently, you never know who may show up, but there is like a pretty a loyal following of people who come to the main stage. And this might not be a show that they would actively seek out, but I think it is one that they may actively need. And I'm very grateful to the department, to Dan, to Rob Diemer, everyone who has put in so much time and effort to make this a possibility. It's wonderful.
Alexa, from you?
I also feel so incredibly excited about it. We have opportunities to direct through clubs on campus, and it's always very exciting to see students be able to do that. However, we've never really had an opportunity to have professors guide us through it. And I feel like by having a professor guide us and having the resources of the department, it's able to allow me to create my entire artistic vision and not just scramble to find what I can. And it's really a wonderful way to be able to have a world premiere of a play because there are so many resources. We do have money and people to make it happen. So it's been really wonderful to see how this has all fleshed out.
I won't say that I'm stunned. I mean, the department's done original plays before, but this is really an historic moment. My congratulations to both of you for this. You know, I think probably it's about time we got to talk a little bit about the plot of the play and what it's about. And I think I'm going to turn, Ashley, you'll forgive me, but I'm going to turn to the director to ask her about the play, because it's interesting to find out what the person who's actually directing the play, how they see the plot and the characters and so on and so forth. And then we'll come back to you, because the director playwright relationship is an interesting one. So Alexa, take off. Tell me about a little bit about the plot of the play, the story of the play, what happens, and so on.
Sure. So the story centers around a woman named Mason Wright, and it kind of jumps back and forth between her when she's 22 and when she's 15. So the play starts when she's 22, and she goes to the doctor. She finds out that she may be infertile. And she has this puppet that follows her around who is used as a device throughout the show. The puppet is on the hand of an actor, and the actor controls it throughout the entire show. And it kind of represents the voice in Mason's head, the thoughts that we don't say out loud. And so Mason has a partner, her name is Rose, that she sort of confides in about this, but doesn't to the extent that Rose may want. So Rose kind of seeks out other people to try and find out more about Mason, what's going on with her. And she ends up finding this man named Oscar that Mason knew from her past. And once Oscar comes into the picture, there is a flashback to when she's 15, and then the story kind of intertwines between 22 and 15. So Oscar is somebody that she knew when she was 15. He was 22. So then we see that age gap of 15 and 22, which is why we see Mason at 22, because it kind of, the memories of him at 22 come up when she is that age. So we see their relationship, her relationship with a woman named Victoria, who was also a teenager at the time. And there is also a personified version of a little girl that Mason sees in her head, but nobody else can see. And there's a lot of puppetry and porcelain versions of characters that we see to help guide the story, because it does move so quickly sometimes between the age of 15 and the age of 22. But overall, it's a story that is about coming of age, the journey from childhood to adulthood, and how all of these characters have helped her move from 15 to 22, how they have shaped her, how these experiences with them have shaped her. And it's quite beautiful to see Mason's journey throughout the play.
That's very interesting. Ashley, you have seemed to have employed a number of highly theatrical techniques in writing this. You didn't choose to go for a straight narrative. Why was that?
I think it's because my brain thinks in cartoons sometimes. And it didn't feel right to tell this story so stuck in reality, because sometimes, I don't know about if you can speak to this too, Alexa, but sometimes being a woman feels like you're living in a fantasy land. Like sometimes the things that happen to you are so absurd that the only explanation is that this, oh, this is all puppets. This is all puppetry. I'm a toy. This is all this is. And it came from a deep inspiration from my grandmother, who is a toy collector. And that has defined so much of my life. I know so much about Cabbage Patch Kids. And I really wanted to tell the story about this woman who sees her life through these toys, through these theatrical devices, and how when she comes into her adulthood, when she comes into a person beyond the fact that sometimes life treats her like a porcelain, fragile thing, she can put that idea in the past and just be a person, that her autonomy is freedom. And it just felt like the right devices to choose. And plus with the language, it can be quite lofty and beautiful at times. I thought, you know, highly theatrical devices plus beautiful language makes wonderful music. So very often something troubling happens to Mason, but then it is followed by the puppet being like, hey, we're going to talk about something fun. I'm going to take care of you, because though this is getting real and heavy, like, I am here to support you. You will be okay. That was very important, especially because some of the subject matter in this play does get very heavy at times. Even it's hard for me to watch. But
I can imagine. Alexa, you have two very important things to deal with as the director. You have the actors to deal with, and you have the script to deal with, which occasionally, probably, I'm going to guess, needed some rewriting along the way. How have you been working with the actors in relationship to the script and in relationship to rewrites and all of those kinds of challenges?
Yeah, so Ashley actually came into our rehearsals up until the last day that she was going to be finished editing the script. So we had a final version of it for performances. And I thought it was really cool when actors would say, this doesn't feel supernatural to say, what can I do to like make it better or make it feel more natural? And instead of me working with it, Ashley would say, oh, I'll just rewrite it. And it was really cool to see that collaboration, because a lot of times when we work on a script and there's lines that we say, oh, this feels so unnatural. Oh, this feels kind of out of character. There's nothing we can do about it, and we just have to work with it. But instead, for this project, we were able to talk about it, see why it didn't feel natural. And then Ashley could say, okay, I'll rewrite it. And it could be a line as simple as three words that was changed. And I also feel like there were a lot of like blocking choices that I would make that Ashley would then write into the script, or that she would say, ooh, that's really cool. What if we added this on top of that? And it would add another plot point, or it would add another way to move the story along based off what I was doing in the room. So it was a very collaborative process between me, Ashley, and the actors.
And Ashley, I'm going to ask you a challenging question then. Now, are you having worked with original scripts myself, one of the dangers I always told the playwright was you got to be careful about what the actors say, because you're not writing a play for that specific actor. You're writing a play for hopefully a whole bunch of actors who will come later on to perform this piece as well. In the working with the actors, how do you manage to balance that idea between, you know, making a specific actor comfortable by rewriting it, as opposed to looking at your vision and saying, no, I think I want to keep those words that way for this particular reason?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like in my writing, one of my pitfalls as a greener writer is that all of my characters talk like me. Isn't always normal. So when I see actors doing this, they all have very vastly different interpretations of the characters. They all have their own unique personalities. And sometimes, yeah, I write a line and it is bonkers. Crazy. And they helped me like direct my vision towards, okay, this is a man in his 20s. He's burnt out. How do I actually put that onto the page in a way that's realistic as to, you know, the vision of a man in his 20s told through the lens of a girl who was 19 at the time while writing this, which has been greatly beneficial to the script. And in terms of like keeping the continuity and my vision the same, I almost like the idea that these actors have an imprinted vision of themselves on this page. And though it might change in future edits, I kind of like that legacy that the next time this is done and I make edits, there will be more pieces of other people who had their thoughts and visions on it. And I kind of like that the language legacy of people once past.
Wow. Okay, well, that's a great answer to a great question. So thank you. I appreciate that. Oh my gosh, ladies, I have enjoyed this conversation immensely, and I could talk to both of you for at least another hour about this, because playwriting fascinates me. Original production is, I think, at the heart of theatrical endeavor. Every play that we know to be a famous play at once started as an unknown, unworked, untested script. And I think that one of the great things that can possibly happen, particularly at the college level, is to be able to understand that process, what it means to create a piece of theater from nothing, from words on a page, and that particular process. I had always dreamed that we would do more of that. And if you are a writer or a director who is interested in that, boy, I would encourage you so strongly to continue that. And I wish you the best of luck with this. It's going to be performed in the Bartlett Theater in the Rockefeller Arts Center from Thursday through Saturday, November 30th to December 2nd at 7:30. So it's 3 nights. So people better get out there and watch it. Thank you so much, ladies. I appreciate it. Any final comments?
I would say, you know, tell the mothers in your life, whether they be mothers or not, thank you, just from us.
I will do that. Okay, thank you, ladies. Take care. Good luck. You will only have 3 chances to see the groundbreaking work of these 2 students. As Mason Wright is not a mother, we'll have only 3 performances. The play will run Thursday through Saturday, November 30th through December 2nd at 7:30 p.m. in the Bartlett Theater. You can obtain tickets by calling the SUNY Fredonia campus box office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. My personal congratulations go out to these 2 remarkable women on their achievement. Once we've all finished stuffing ourselves over Thanksgiving, the holiday officially gets started, and the region has a number of events to celebrate the season. I had the opportunity to speak with Dr. Vernon Huff, the Director of Choral Activities at the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, as well as Mr. Jefferson Westwood, the Director of Rockefeller Arts Center, to find out what they had going on. Let's hear from both of them, starting with Dr. Huff. It is really always a treat to get to talk to Dr. Vernon Huff. He is the Director of Choral Activities and Associate Professor of Choral Music Education over at SUNY Fredonia School of Music. Vernon, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
Always glad to have you on the program. Now, You're going to be featuring the chamber choir, the camerata, the college choir, and then combined pieces and all of that. And the program is rather extensive, and there's so many things to talk about. So I thought the direction that I would take personally is to just give you the time to pick which ones you chose and why you chose that, maybe one or two from each group. And let's talk about the music involved, because a lot of times people will recognize the title, but it's not just the title, it's the arrangement, it's the challenge for the students, just whatever it is. So let's start with the chamber choir. What have you got there?
Okay. When we're thinking about putting together this concert more than any other concert that we do, it's a joint collaboration. We have three groups and we have three different conductors. And so we're thinking about putting together a whole concert, not necessarily that sort of weaves a story or tells a narrative, but that the audience at the end of the evening can go home and go, that was pretty special. And we all have favorites when it comes to holiday music, right? We hear things that remind us of childhood. So many sentiments are associated with a lot of this music. It will remind us of a family member or an occasion. So I try to keep that in mind when we're programming things. But also, I'd like to challenge our audiences a little bit. So you won't find just a sort of a hymnal arrangement of Joy to the World. You know, everybody's done that or heard that. So we want to do sort of like a fresh take on it a little bit. But with the chamber choir program, I wanted to do things that were challenging. If this is supposed to be, you know, our top group, you know, I want to do things that will challenge the students and also challenge the audience a little bit. One of my favorite arrangers of spirituals is a man named Stacy Gibbs. And Stacy has been to our campus twice now and arranged a lot of music for us. And so his arrangement of Seed That Babe, the students immediately fell in love with it. And it just tells the story of them at the manger. But it's set in, you know, the way Stacy composes, it's completely rhythmic. And so it's like once you start a Stacy Gibbs piece, you sort of get on a train and you ride that train into the end of the song and you just can't help but groove the whole time. And Stacy's music is just incredible. We have a piece from the Jewish tradition called Five-Sided Zvivon. And I wanted to include something from the Jewish tradition on this concert. You know, I talk to a lot of my friends who are Jewish that say it's the Christians who make a big deal out of Hanukkah. You know,
I've heard that too.
But there's so much music that's a part of that tradition that is not my own, which is different. You know, it's composed in minor keys or different modes. So that can challenge our students, too. So I wanted to make sure I got a good piece from that tradition as well. And then I also wanted to make sure that we talk about, you know, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, which is always an audience favorite. Mm-hmm. We don't sing that. When we sing it, if we're going to be true to the way that's sung, we want to sing it in the sort of 1950s, 1960s style. If you think about singers and crooners from that era. So, you know, bring a little Frank Sinatra to the audience is what we try to do.
You know. Yeah, well, they're going to like that, too. And I think that, you know, I've worked at the Jewish Repertory Theater on a number of occasions over my career. And when I work during this time of year, during the Christmas time of year, they talk about the Five-Sided Zvivon as that mm-hmm. other dreidel song. Uh-huh. Everybody kind of knows dreidel, 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 but they don't. This is the other one that I understand this one's very interesting because it's a 5-4.
It's 5-4. No, yeah. Absolutely. And so being able to feel that because, you know, singers, we think in twos and fours, right? And occasionally we think of threes if we're doing some waltzes. But to do a whole piece in five, you know, if as a conductor, if you let up for a second, it'll get away from you.
Right.
So that's been a challenge for the students and the conductor as well.
Let's move on to the camerata. You've got about four pieces coming from the camerata. Which ones do you like here? What's going on with them?
My favorite one that they're doing is John Rutter's arrangement of Tomorrow Will Be My Dancing Day. That's one of my favorite Christmas tunes of all time. Mm-hmm. And it's glorious and it's set very well for treble voices. So the camerata is, it used to be known as the women's choir. And so we're taking, you know, working with higher voices, soprano and alto. So finding songs in that sort of repertoire, you know, you'd have to dig sometimes to find some really good pieces. And Brent Weber is our conductor of Camerata, and he's found some really great pieces. The Rudder piece is great. He's doing Patapan, which is another seasonal favorite. And they just have a great sound this year. So I'm excited for the audiences to hear them. Because when we think choirs, we think, you know, SATB. And that's right. Not always the case. And another one that he's doing, Patterns of the Snow, that's by Marie Valverde. Yes. We're doing a lot of Valverde lately. She's an up-and-coming composer out of St. Olaf. And her stuff is just absolutely striking. So I know the audience is really going to love that.
Great. And then we got the college choir coming up, and they also have four pieces.
And Adam Lubke directs the college choir, and that happens to be the university's oldest choral ensemble. And that's our largest audition choir. And Adam always does a mix of sort of traditional choral music and lighthearted favorites. So one is Hodie Christus Natus Est by Sveilinck, which is a great tune. He's doing some Poulenc, and which I love. One of my bucket list goals is to conduct every Poulenc piece before I retire.
Oh, wow. And that's just, and that's in 16 and a half years, am I correct?
In 16 and a half years, not that I'm calling. But his the colors that Poulenc paints, the tonal colors he uses, it's just exquisite. So I know the audience will really like that. And then with the combined pieces, I'm going to stay with Lubke because we always end with three combined pieces because we each want to, you know, have our hand working with the large choir, which correct. To me is just a blast to be able to do. So Dr. Lubke's conducting the third movement of Pinkham's Christmas Cantata. And he's using a full brass choir for that.
Wow.
And it's that will end the concert, and it just will really be incredible. And speaking of, you know, we're talking about time signatures. That one goes from, I think, 4-4 to 3-4 to 8-8, divided into threes and twos and everything. And it's just it's been a tremendous challenge for us. Yes. But I think the audience will really enjoy that.
Yes, yes. And that one really has a again, it's one of those things where, you know, you think of Gloria in Excelsis Deo, and you have if you know anything about Latin masses or people who have developed those, there's a very, very a defined rhythm to that. But when I looked that one up and listened to it for a very short period of time, it was like, I think it goes from 2-4 to 3-4 to, you know, it's just all over the map. And if you don't have a good, you know, solid beat and structure on it, you can fall apart pretty quickly because it's that complicated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, and that's what composers from that time a lot were doing. They would figure out how they were going to set things, and then they would take the time signatures and sort of lay it down on top of that. Stravinsky was a big one for that. So, you know, you're going fives and twos and then threes. And then I think later composers sort of strayed away from that, but that's right in Pinkham's wheelhouse.
Yeah.
And it's a phenomenal piece.
Yeah, that's going to be very, very enjoyable. I have to pull out one favorite of mine only because Gordon Lightfoot was somebody I grew up with as a folk singer. And I guess they're doing a version of his song for the Winter's Night arranged by Hannah Walt. And that song itself, just by itself, I mean, the way he plays it is so evocative of winter and the solitude that it brings and sort of like the melancholy that it brings too at times. And I was, again, I know the song very well, but the arrangement that I heard really does a nice job with it. If they're going to do that, basically that same arrangement.
And it's arranged by Michael Hanawalt, who I believe teaches at Florida State now, who was a classmate of Adams. Hmm. But that's another side of this time of year, right? The desolation, the eeriness, the cold and the chill. And I think being able to talk about that part of the season, I think, is important too. It's not all, you know, candy canes and Christmas trees, although that's some fun of it too.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, and I very much agree with you. And I guess there's also one last piece I picked out, which people are going to recognize as the Carol of the Bells, but it doesn't have the lyrics of the Carol of the Bells, the Little Swallow.
Oh, yes. And I think he might be doing that in the Ukrainian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's the Little Swallow, and then Shredik, I believe, is the Ukrainian.
Yes.
So that would be a nice treat too.
Yes, it will. Yes, that's great. Wonderful. Now, Vernon, with all of this music that you have, I understand that it's a very you have a very special part of this concert. I believe that WNED is going to produce it, and they're going to do some amazing things with the students and the concert.
Absolutely. And this will be our third year of partnering with WNED. In fact, we had our production meeting this morning with their vice president of programming. And what we do is it's recorded by our student engineers, directed by Barrett Gottinger. And then our videographer and our marketing department will do fade-ins, fade-outs. They'll interview the dean. They'll do some promos. And that'll all be incorporated into about a 53-minute show. And so that's going to be available for folks who are in the Buffalo, Toronto area on Friday, the 22nd of December at 10 p.m. And then Sunday, Christmas Eve, at 4:30 p.m. And what's really neat, Tom, is we've developed, our students do good work. So we've developed a good reputation with this. So it is going to be available, I don't know when yet, but on all New York PBS stations this year and next. And then it will be put in the pipeline for PBS North America for next year, for 2024.
Wow.
We're just really proud of this program and this partnership we have with WNED.
Wow. Congratulations. And I'm going to take the time not only to congratulate you for that, because I know you guys do great work and it's getting it out, but the School of Music itself has really been hitting its stride lately with Grammy nominations and so on and so forth. So let's do what we can to make sure we publicize that as much as we can, Vernon.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It looks like, Vernon, you have a really nice holiday concert here, and you've put together some really interesting things that I think are going to take the audiences on a nice musical journey. So thank you for that. Thanks for the work that you and your colleagues do, bringing this kind of choral music to the place. It's always great on the holidays to go to a choral concert and sit and listen to that stuff, I think.
It is. It really is. And, the music's really good. But at the same time, when we unpack these tunes every year, it's like conversations meeting old friends again,
Right. Right.
And, when I hear Silent Night, it evokes certain feelings and nostalgia. And so that's a part of what makes the music so special, I think, Tom.
Yes, I would agree with you. Vernon, thank you for your time. And thank you for previewing this concert, because I think that, what you've been able to give us insight into some of the melodies, hopefully people go, oh, I want to go to that now, because now I know what's going on. And let's hope you get a good audience.
Okay. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Vernon. The Fredonia Holiday Choral Concert, featuring the Fredonia Chamber Choir, the Fredonia Camerata, and the University Choir, will be performed on Saturday, December 2nd at 8 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Admission is free. Here is the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks, November 22nd through December 6th. The 1891 Fredonia Opera House, in cooperation with Fredonia's Miracle on Main Street Festival, will present a free showing of the movie Polar Express. The movie screens on Saturday, December 2nd, beginning at 4 p.m. The Department of Visual Arts and New Media Photography students will exhibit their photography work opening on Monday, November 20th, and continuing through Thursday, November 30th, in the Marion Art Gallery at the Rockefeller Arts Center. See the Marion Art Gallery website for times when the gallery is open. The Fredonia New Jazz Ensemble will perform on Tuesday, November 28th, in the Rausch Recital Hall beginning at 8 p.m., The Fredonia University Chorus will perform on Wednesday, November 29th, beginning at 8 p.m. in King Concert Hall. And the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra will perform on Thursday, November 30th, in Rausch Recital Hall, beginning at 8 p.m. All these School of Music events are free and open to the public. And remember, if you have an arts event coming up and would like to get it mentioned on the arts calendar, please just send us an email to operahouse@fredopera.org or call the box office at 716-679-1891 with your information. We'll be glad to get you on the calendar. The Rockefeller Arts Center always has a holiday offering for the season, and this year, it's no different. In fact, there are two holiday shows this year, and I spoke with Jefferson Westwood to get some more details about what's coming up. Joining me now is the director of the Rockefeller Arts Center over at SUNY Fredonia, Mr. Jefferson Westwood. Jefferson, as always, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's so great to be back.
Excellent. Excellent. Always love to have you. Now, you know, you are so good at this because you've been at it for quite some time, 40 years and plus, I think now.
Yeah.
And you always present a great holiday season. So I figured since it's getting near the holidays and, you know, we want to be able to publicize what you're doing over there. Let's talk about the two items that you've got coming up for holiday viewing and enjoyment. And we'll go with the first one. I think it's the Kaleidoscope series, which is still running. That's on December the 6th at 6:30 p.m.
Yeah, that's a Wednesday. I'm so thrilled. This is the first time we've brought this group here. It's the Barter Players of the Barter Theater Company from Virginia. And they are the State Theater of Virginia. They're one of the oldest, longest running professional repertory theater companies in the country. They have a, you know, elaborate home season, but they also tour family fare that they develop right there, you know, with their in-house writers and directors and producers and creative team. And this is a show called Frosty, a Musical Adventure. And it's basically an hour long, you know, reinvention of the Frosty the Snowman story, but it's not with the music that everybody knows, the song Frosty the Snowman, but it's about an orphan basically who's out on the street, and this top magical top hat every 50 years can bring things to life, and he puts it on the snowman's head, and they have adventures all over this city of the borough of Manhattan. So especially for people who know Manhattan at all, or have been even a tourist, they'll go to lots of familiar sights that you will imagine in your head as the background.
Well, you know, Manhattan has always been such a wonderful setting for any Christmas story. So many of them, you know, take place on Manhattan. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. It's a feel-good story. There's a social worker involved who manages to get him hooked up with the help he needs. And I think it's a 4 or 5-person cast, but many of them go off stage, change costumes, and come back as a different character. Mm-hmm. And do such a good job, I think, that a lot of the kids in the audience won't realize it's the same actor they just saw a few minutes ago. So it's just very nicely done. It's a play with music. It has some singing, but it's more of, I guess I would call it more of a play with music than a musical per se.
Okay.
It's a very sweet touching. I've seen the whole video of it, and they're just top notch actors. And we're doing a 6:30 curtain time because of the equity rules about how many hours you can be on the road and how many hours you can have in your workday. And they have to get you know, to the next stop on the itinerary for the next day. I said, well, I've never done 6:30 before, but yeah, I'll do that and see. And the sales are going fine. I think some people are happier to get their kids to bed even a little earlier.
You know, I had actually thought the 6:30 curtain was because it was a children's show mostly. Yeah. You get a lot of kids there, and 6:30 just seems to be the perfect time, especially if there's something that only lasts, you know, an hour or so.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I want to, you know, just take a second to talk up the Barter Theater, because that's actually quite a historical theater. It was started in the Depression. It comes from Abington, Virginia, and it was actually started in the Depression. And the man who started it, his name is Robert Porterfield, and he started the theater in the Depression. And basically the reason it's called the Barter Theater is because what he did was he created this theater, and rather than take cash, he would take bartered goods from people in the region, leftover vegetables, meat, whatever it is that they had, and they would bring those things to the theater, and in exchange he would present the play for them. And that's how the Barter Theater got started. One of his most famous quotes is, "With vegetables that you cannot sell, you can buy a good laugh."
I'm so glad to know that history.
Yeah.
You know, and speaking of making the arts available to people who don't have the cash for the normal price of admission, I want your listeners to know that with this production particularly, we are reaching out to the community, and we want to let people know if the normal price of admission is a barrier to attendance, just call us and let us know. Mention the name Dallas K. Beale. We have a fund at the Fredonia College Foundation named after the president emeritus, no longer living, I'm sad to say, of our campus, Dallas K. Beale, who hired me back in 1982. And it's a permanent endowment, and the earnings from that fund are to go to help people attend shows that they can't, you know, don't have the money for, but they'd still like to be here. And so we have tried over the years to work with different nonprofit agencies in town, and we've had some trouble just sustaining that. And during the pandemic, we were not doing it at all, of course. So some funds have built up there. So we're going more public with it this Christmas. And when people call the box office, they just, or come in, they need to let us know that they would like that. And we will, and it's nice for Rockefeller, because we still get the income, you know, that we might have if we'd sold that ticket to somebody who was, let's just say, as privileged as you and I have been over the years, that we could afford these things when we want to.
You know, for all the years that I worked there and worked with you, I never knew that. And that's that's a splendid thing. Thank you for mentioning that. I hope people take advantage of that.
Me too.
Okay, so you have another offering coming up as well. You really, you know, you're packing them in one after the other.
Right. 2 days later.
2 days later, you're going to bring in your you always do a Christmas Pops concert. Everybody
that's
knows
right.
that. That's a thing that, you know, has been going on for years and years and years. And this year you're bringing in the River City Brass, I believe. And they're from Pittsburgh. Yeah, is that
they
right?
They are. They are. A lot of people refer to them as the Boston Pops of brass bands. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't know the history of brass bands. I think they formed and are very popular in the United Kingdom. And in fact, in the outside of London, a lot of the industrial cities and coal mining cities, the major company in town will sponsor a brass band, typically with their own employees as members and as amateur musicians. But some get really good, and they have competitions, and they have difficult to play music, you know. And a brass band is just what it sounds like. It is a concert band with no woodwinds and limited percussion, I'll say. But, you know, no flutes, no piccolos, no oboes, no clarinets, no bassoons, just And to cover all of the range of from low to high, of course, we've got tubas, but there will be some what they call piccolo trumpets, little tiny trumpets to hit the real high notes. Mm-hmm. And for the last few years, they've had a new artistic director who actually was imported from England, and he's got personality. And I'm sorry, cannot remember his name at the moment, but I've looked at their repertoire, and I'm very excited about the music they're going to play.
What do we got?
Well, they have a Christmas overture by Nigel Hess. They're doing Oh Holy Night, Snoopy's Christmas, you know, from the Charlie Brown. There's a piece called Three Kings Swing. So Ooh. That's sort of probably a big band take on We Three Kings of Orient Are. They also have some very contemporary stuff, like they have a medley from Frozen, the Disney animated movie. They have a medley from Polar Express. And then things like Little Drummer Boy, All I Want for Christmas, Carol of the Bells, The Christmas Song. And since your audience, I think, is somewhat the cognoscenti of our area, do you think maybe, possibly so?
Possibly, yeah. I think we skew that way demographically, yeah.
Maybe a little bit. So I will just say, don't be surprised if you hear Leroy Anderson's Sleigh Ride as an encore.
So
whatever you do, make sure you pack long enough that they will give you an encore. We're not supposed to publish it in the program, but they didn't say they didn't say not to tell Tom Laughlin about it.
Are you going to come out and play the sleigh bells?
Oh, if they let me. Yeah, I could. You know, people have asked me, Jefferson, when are you going to get up on stage and sing? I said, well, I have one basically guiding principle in my programming. I don't like people asking for their money back. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm not singing.
Well, that's the Holiday Brasstacular, Friday, December 8th at 7:30 in the King Concert Hall, and that should be pretty good. You know, it's really interesting that you mentioned that history about the brass bands, by the way, because, you know, I mean, Music Man was built on the whole idea of brass bands in the Midwest, mm-hmm. and, uh-huh. you know, the Music Man would go around and sell brass instruments to all those kids. So, you know, that tradition is actually, you know, pretty strong around the turn of the century. So, you know, it's good history to have. And, and brass instruments are really kind of, you know, just fun to listen to, the way they sort of mix with each other.
Yeah. We have a clip on our website, you know, of them, a YouTube clip if people want to preview it. And let me mention that our offer of free tickets, through the Dallas K. Beale Fund, free to the person who requests it and the families would like us to subsidize their attendance, but we still earn the income from it. That offer is also good for the River City Brass Band Brasstacular on Friday, the 8th of December.
Great. Yeah. You know, I'm going to make sure that I put a little note in the show notes down below so that people can, if they look at the show notes, they'll read that and see that. So take advantage of that. Jefferson, as always, it's wonderful to talk to you. I hope these two events go well for you. Tickets sell well because they sound like they're pretty nice events for the holidays.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you for having me back.
You bet. Anytime, Jefferson. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Frosty, a Musical Adventure, will be performed on Wednesday, December 6th, at the special time of 6:30 p.m. in the Marvel Theater at Rockefeller Arts Center. That will be followed by the Christmas Pops Concert by River City Brass, entitled Holiday Brasstacular, which will be performed on Friday, December 8th, beginning at 7:30 p.m. in King Concert Hall. Tickets for both events can be obtained through the SUNY Fredonia Campus Box Office at 716-673-3501 or online at www.fredonia.edu/tickets. And please, remember to take advantage of the offer through the Dallas K. Beale Foundation if you'd like to attend either show but can't afford the ticket price. Please come on out and enjoy yourself. Finally, a somber note. The day that this podcast is released, Wednesday, November 22nd, 2023, marks the 60th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Like many others of my age and generation, we can remember the exact moment and what we were doing when we learned the news that the president had been shot to death. I was doing some math exercises in my fifth grade classroom when Mr. Monaco, the largest man on the school's teaching faculty, came bursting into the room, red in the face, tears streaming down his cheeks, to tell my teacher, and by way of extension, the entire class, that President Kennedy was dead. Some historians today say that moment in American history marked the end of America's age of innocence. These words from his inaugural address in 1960 seem innocent against today's political backdrop. Yet for me and many others, they can still spark whatever ember of hope is left within us.
In the long history of the world, only a few generations have been granted the role of defending freedom in its hour of maximum danger. I do not shrink from this responsibility. I welcome it. I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation. The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man. Finally, whether you are citizens of America or citizens of the world, ask of us here the same high standards of strength and sacrifice which we ask of you. With a good conscience, our only sure reward, with history the final judge of our deeds, let us go forth to lead the land we love, asking his blessing and his help, but knowing that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own.
Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just looked around and he's
And that's it for this sausage-stuffing edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Ashley Jacho, Alexa Adler, Vernon Huff, and Jefferson Westwood for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, December 6th, 2023. I'm Tom Lachlan. And until then, be safe out there. And be kind to one another.